Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. You might be interested in a series of talks we are giving at University College Cork on Friday, the 3rd of May. 8 expert speakers in the field of natural history, including some of our own stars, Aine and Ilana, Niall Hatch, Terry Flanagan and Jim Wilson, will give 13-minute presentations, nice and short and sweet, which will then be transformed into radio programmes and podcasts, which will be released and broadcast during the summer. Stay tuned till the end of the programme and we'll give you some more details of how you can attend. But I want to take you back to the 1st of April. April Fool's Day, our wonderful Nature on One documentary about the magpie. The magpie, you see, is a much maligned bird. It has a reputation for being a thief. It's also said that magpies will eat anything, including birds' eggs and chicks. They're also thought to be one of the smartest birds in the world. In a special Nature on One documentary from the Mooney Goes Wild team, biologist Terry Flanagan debunks some of the myths and gets an insight into just why we have such strong feelings about this beautiful and intelligent creature.
The feeling I have when I'm out in the wild on my own is total tranquility and just happiness. So that's where it's where I work best and it's where I long to be. I don't like to be indoors if I can avoid it. I need to be outside to recharge.
It's a warm spring day in March. I'm in Carrigtwohill, County Cork, with sound recordist Sean Ronan. Sean is on a mission to record every Irish bird species.
That's actually an alarm call, and that's the most commonly heard call given by magpies. It's the one that people will be most familiar with, that chattering sound.
Is that a male or a female? Can you tell?
No, so there's only one call type that is exclusive to females, and it's a call that's given when the males bring food back to the nest. Many of the other calls are shared by both sexes, including this one.
It's a very familiar sound to us, that. Is it a call or a song?
It's a call, and it's most typically used to either scold predators or to warn others that there's a predator coming.
So there are differences, discrete differences, between calls and songs?
Oh yeah, absolutely. A call is just a small soundbite of information, akin to our hello or a short warning, and a song is much more elaborate, and it's used as a display, either to attract a female or to proclaim a territory.
Now, that call of the magpie, it's not really very well liked by people.
The chattering call?
Yeah.
I suppose it's quite a raucous call, but magpies have a very big vocabulary, a very large repertoire of sounds, and some of them are really beautiful.
Do you like that call?
That call? I think I like every call, every bird call.
Whatever about the sounds that magpies make, there's no mistaking how they look. Pretty much everyone in Ireland can identify this bird.
Yeah, I'd say you're right. It's black and white, and I mean, there are virtually no birds like it. I mean, it's very distinctive.
Professor Brendan Kavanagh has been studying magpies for many decades now.
I must say, particularly at springtime when they're getting into mating and the breeding season, that black and the white are just so distinctive. And then you have that iridescence, that beautiful coloration like a rainbow right through the black. It's beautiful.
And is there any particular reason why they have that? Is that for mate attraction?
I would imagine that if they are in good condition, that the iridescence is more obvious, and it's certainly more obvious in springtime. So you're probably on the right trail there, yeah.
Magpies are members of the family Corvidae, which also includes jackdaws, jays and rooks, considered to be among the smartest creatures on the planet. But another characteristic that sets the magpie apart from other members of the crow family is its long tail.
The magpie, when you think about its place within the ecosystem, the magpie lives within more cover. If you think of a crow, the crow loves the open air and it likes to kind of fly long distances in a straight line, if you want. The magpie, on the other hand, lives in a more built-up type of habitat and it needs more manoeuvrability. That's really what it's down to. That tail is like a rudder on a ship. It's able to turn the bird very quickly in the air. And that helps them, number one, avoid being predated. It also helps them if they are chasing something else, they are more dexterous in terms of getting around. So all in all, the tail, and you'd often see them when they're playing with each other or sparring with each other. They're very versatile. They're able to dance around, and it's that tail that gives them that skill. And any skill that an animal has that another one hasn't is a positive advantage.
They only arrived relatively recently in Ireland, a couple of hundred years ago. But since they've arrived, their numbers have mushroomed.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, that one, Terry. The suggestion is that they came over about the middle of the 17th century, that they might have been blown over on a storm from somewhere in the UK, probably in Wales, and that they established a small population in Wexford at that particular time. Now, after that, the records are very few and far between. And really, because they were always persecuted. You must remember that the old land system of the large estates, they automatically would have had a gamekeeper. The gamekeeper was told to keep down the magpies. So they didn't really expand for a long, long, long time. It's probably really the early part of the last century when the estates were broken up after we got independence, perhaps from the UK, that it's at that point a lot of the gamekeepers, their jobs were gone. And that gave the magpie an opportunity then to expand.
And when it expanded, did it expand in rural areas or did it move into urban and suburban areas?
It started in rural areas. It would always have preferred, if you want, rural areas at that particular time. But remember as well that agriculture has changed very, very dramatically. I mean, we've gone through an agricultural revolution as well. And perhaps the food available in the countryside then was greater than it is now. But the food available in the cities is greater now than it would have been then. So it was a dynamic where agriculture was changing the countryside and modern sort of cities were changing what was available in the cities at the same time.
So what is the situation now?
Well, the densities in the cities are far greater than the densities in the rural countryside. But if you think about it, the amount of hedgerow that we have in the countryside has disappeared or has gone down very dramatically. So while the countryside can't hold as many magpies as it could have held in the past, the city can hold far more magpies now than it used to hold in the past.
But just how are magpies faring?
So if you look at this graph here, Terry, it starts back in 1998, and that's the year that the Countryside Bird Survey started. So we've surveyors, National Parks and Wildlife Service rangers and volunteers and Birdwatch Ireland staff members all over the country surveying different parts of the countryside, essentially, to get a feel for what the birds are doing.
Birdwatch Ireland have been monitoring bird population trends for over 30 years now. With the Countryside Bird Survey, which takes place every summer, and the Garden Bird Survey in winter. Coordinator Brian Burke took me through the results.
The last time we ran all the numbers in a big way was 2016. In the 10 years before that, magpies had declined 10%. And between 1998 and 2016, they declined 18%, which is quite a big decline.
Yeah, and of course, this is just in the countryside.
If we look at the Garden Bird Survey, we can see that magpie numbers in urban areas are much, much higher than they are in the rural areas. So if we look at Leinster, if we just take things by province, if you look at Leinster, magpie are the fourth most common species, but they're the sixth most common in all the other provinces. And obviously Leinster has Dublin. It's got a lot of big urban and suburban centres, you know, and that's where we see the differences. If we split things out just based on whether a garden is in an urban or suburban area versus a rural area, we see the same difference. So they're the fourth most common bird in suburban and urban areas, sixth in rural areas. So there's quite a noticeable difference.
And this is very noticeable then in the last 30 years, this increase.
Yes, it seems to be kind of a progressive trend. And we see it not just in Ireland, it's happening in the UK and in all over Europe as well, where magpies are not doing as well in the rural areas, but they're increasingly kind of taking advantage of urban and suburban areas and the kind of advantages that there are there.
And the advantages being people.
Yeah, in a nutshell, it's people. In urban and suburban areas, temperature is a difference. So in those areas, temperature tends to be a couple of degrees higher than it is in the surrounding countryside. So that benefits the birds. You've also got a lot of trees and gardens and in parks and stuff like that. So there's loads of available nesting habitat. Magpies will eat absolutely anything. So with people there, you've got a huge food supply that they can take advantage of. And another thing as well, we see with the Countryside Bird Survey that hooded crows have increased quite a significant amount over the last 25 years. And they are the only species that is implicated as a nest predator of magpie.
And what about the hooded crow then in cities?
You will see them in cities, but they're much, much shyer than magpies. So they do kind of keep their distance. They're not nearly the same high densities as you get magpies in towns and cities. So the magpies just have a bit of safety there, where magpies aren't that afraid of people and hooded crows are. So there's kind of a bit of a buffer there that people are providing.
So wherever you have people, you're going to have magpies.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And, you know, they nest at much higher densities in towns and cities all across Europe than they do in the countryside.
So overall, the trend, you would say, is that the magpie numbers, while healthy throughout the country, are dropping somewhat in the countryside, but increasing in urban and suburban areas.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. And I suppose it shows the value of having different types of surveys, looking at different types of habitat, different times of the year, and we can piece it all together and get, a full picture of how the population is doing. And it's not just clear cut whether it's up or down. You know, it's up in some places and down in others.
One of the reasons why magpies are doing so well is down to their nesting strategies. Not only will magpies nest high up in country hedgerows, but they will regularly nest in suburban gardens. Microbiologist Dr. Martine Brennan has been keeping a close eye on the magpies at her home in Dunshaughlin, County Meath.
We're looking at the ash tree in my garden, and the magpie nest is up there, and it's the second year that the magpies have been nesting there, and I keep watching them. And if you look very carefully, Terry, you can see there is a magpie sitting in the nest now.
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
And you missed it. You came too late, Terry, because I did see them mating outside the nest.
Really?
This morning, yes.
This morning?
Yes, and that's the first time I've seen it this season.
And the mating was in the tree?
In the tree, right outside the nest.
And what happened then?
Then one flew down into the garden and started feeding. The other disappeared. And then the one that was on the lawn flew back up and went into the nest.
Now, you said that this nest was used last year. So was there much work done this year in tidying it up?
Oh, there was very little of the nest left, so they really had to start from scratch this year.
So there's the second one. He's after arriving there in the tree, and he's right up at the nest now. Is that normal?
Yes, yeah. We see them go up very frequently.
Now, he doesn't seem to have anything in his mouth. He's not carrying anything.
He must be just checking on her.
Yeah, because she's in there, because we can see the movement in the nest still.
Yeah, well, you can see the tail going up and down.
Yeah, it's an incredible sight. Does that happen often? Does she sit in there?
I haven't noticed her in there until today. That's the first day that she's been sitting in there, as far as I know.
So then she's probably just getting that nest sorted and interior decorations that's going on at the moment.
I imagine so, yes.
It's approximately 40 kilometres as the crow flies from Dunshaughlin in County Meath to Dundrum in County Dublin, to the home of broadcaster Derek Mooney, where construction of another large dome-shaped structure is well underway.
Eric!
Derek, how are you doing? Are you well?
Welcome to suburbia.
What can I say? I forgot what suburbia is like, Derek.
Well, come in, you're about to see. Actually, my suburbia has a twist, Eric.
Yes.
Close that door. Do you know what the twist is?
I don't know what the twist is, Derek.
It's the contrast of the soundscape from the front to the back. You're
yes.
in the back now.
Wow.
And behind me, I have Dublin's only working suburban farm, the Airfield Trust.
Oh, the Airfield Trust,
you
of
see?
Course.
So you'll wow. hear cattle, you might hear sheep, and you might even hear the donkey and the red hens and everything else. But
it's
what you've
fabulous.
Come to see is up in that tree there. Just
yes,
come over here, you'll see it a little bit better, Eric.
Oh, yes. The beginnings of a magpie nest.
Ornithologist and author Eric Dempsey is one of Ireland's leading bird experts. He's fascinated by the various nesting strategies adopted by birds.
It's important to remember what a nest is. A nest is purely for laying your eggs, incubating those eggs, and rearing your young. Mm. Birds don't use nests for any other reason. So outside of the breeding season, Derek, birds will be roosting in trees but not using nests. Now, some birds like wrens, we've discussed wrens before, will use a nest box in winter for warmth, but that's a totally different concept. So a nest basically is for rearing your young. And at the moment, the birds are still at the building stage. And a magpie's nest is quite a spectacular thing, really, because it looks from the outside just a bundle of twigs, and they're just like, you know, beginning to sort of just throw these twigs together. But it's quite a complex nest. Many birds, like thrushes, for example, use mud to sort of stabilise the nest, and so do magpies. Mm-hmm. Magpies use mud a bit like, almost like wattling, to create a stable nest, and they will usually build it quite high, and at where there's a sort of a juncture of about 10 branches, because it's quite a big nest, and it's a big nest because they're big birds, and they're going to lay about maybe 5 to 6, you know, greeny brown eggs, which the female alone will incubate. But they will build mud within those stick structures.
Just and to glue them together.
Just to glue them together.
Well, I've seen them bring in plenty of mud. They're both building.
Yes, both adults will build the nest. The female is the one that will do the incubation. So they spend a lot of time building this. And magpies, for their size, are very unusual in that most magpies, not all, will build a roof over the nest. They build a domed sort of nest. So that's a very complicated structure when you think of a big bird. You know, we think of, you know, long-tailed tits or wrens, you know, building these, like, but they have little tiny beaks and, you know, they sort of almost sew everything together. But when you look at a magpie, they're a chunky bird and they're bringing in big sticks. Mm. And there's a lot of sticks on the ground at the moment. So they will be picking up sticks, maybe even up to a foot long, some of them.
I've seen it, and yeah. I've seen them break a lot.
Yeah, and
they're not just picking them up, no, they're not lazy.
No, they're not, and they will actually often go to the tops of branches and hold on to them. Yeah. I've seen other, like, rooks and jackdaws doing it, and they're sort of bouncing on them and breaking them, because a lot of the tips of these branches are brittle, and, you know, they're dry after the winter, there's not much sap in them, so they're easier to break at this time of the year. So they will then build this nest. They'll put a roof on her, as they say, like the Unbelievables. It's a great little country if we could put a roof on her. But of course, that makes sense because you're quite high, so you're open to the elements. And they will have a sort of a side entrance. And then they will put sort of feathers and fur and grass and things. So they build the interior, you know, the interior design, as I always say when it comes to nests. They will make it comfy because they're going to lay up to 5-6 eggs. Those eggs are going to be incubated by the female for about 20 days. So it's at least a 3-week incubation period. And all the while the male is out and hunting for food, and he will be bringing food back to her. I just heard one there going over the back again. Yeah, there he is, actually bringing in a stick. Yeah. Wow, and he's just pushing that in there at the moment, just shoving it in. It's still a long way to go. That'll take another week or so to build. It's still in the process of being built.
Yeah, you can see through it.
Yeah, you can see through it, you know. But the chicks will be in that nest for about 4 weeks before they start fledging and coming out. And that's the process. But it is an extraordinary nest. And to be able to watch them building, it's a real privilege, because it's an art form. It really is. There he is in again. It's an art form. We couldn't replicate. It's very, very difficult. You see, I'm useless at DIY, right? So, you know, really, no matter how many people show me how to do things, I can't do it, right? Nobody shows them how to do this. They do this naturally. They didn't go to nest building school. You know what I mean? It's just something that comes naturally to them. And it's you know, you look at the complexities of some of these nests, and they will build it consistently according to what magpie nests should be.
Yeah, they all pretty much,
you know,
look the same.
Yeah, they all look the same.
Across Europe.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's something that's like genetic in them to build this nest. And they just know how to do it. A magpie's nest is a thing of beauty. It's wonderful. It really is.
Magpies are believed to mate for life. Brendan Kavanagh has spent a number of years observing the mating behaviour and reproductive success of magpies, particularly in Dublin City.
Once they find a mate, which is usually in their second year, they don't actually breed the year after they're born, but the second year after they're born, they find a mate. And the territory is established by the male and female. Both of the individuals maintain that territory. Now, it's not that magpies live forever, but obviously they will remain with that particular mate until such time as something happens to one of them. In that sense, they mate for life.
Is the territory very small?
The territory can be compressed more and more and more. And if we go back to the countryside, for instance, not every piece of farmland is going to be suitable for a magpie, particularly with cutting of hedges and that kind of thing. Whereas in the city, there's a lot more trees. So the nest sites available actually are higher in the city. So they can compress their territories more and more and more. I've actually seen pairs of magpies nesting within 40, 50 metres of each other. That's really as far as I'd say they can push it.
That's extremely close.
Very close. house at very high densities. It's almost like the territoriality starts to break down when the stress is too high because the density of the birds is so high. So they do have that ability to tolerate each other more than you think.
Of course, at this time of the year, they're very, very active and we can see them.
Oh, yeah. The activity starts after Christmas. And I think the first thing you see is these magpie gatherings. You could have 10, 20, 30 magpies all making a fuss in a large tree or a large copse of trees. And then as they fly off, you'll notice them going in twos. So that seems to be like a marital gathering, sometimes it's called. And the pairs once established, the new pairs established at that particular point, will then move away from that. And that's when you start to see, you know, the old adage, one for sorrow, two for joy.
Yeah.
At February and into March, you're going to see two birds generally, two for joy. Then she goes nesting. So she's sitting on the nest, then you start to see one. So don't feel too sorrowful about it. That's just nature doing its thing because she's going to remain on the nest and he's going to be there protecting the territory on his own. Birds which, if you see a congregation of birds at this time of year, a lot of them are non-breeders. They're moving through the established territories, trying to get a view as to which might be good territories for the following year. And you'll get little scraps taking place where individual males are trying to defend these bands of young birds coming through the territory, trying to get a feel for might they have a chance to breed there the following year.
One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl, four for a boy. And we have four. How about that? Isn't that interesting? And they're getting on well with each other, which is interesting, because they should be setting up territories and keeping each other out. There's two more over there in the tree.
There are various collective terms for a group of magpies. A charm, a gulp, or a tiding. Even a parliament and murder have been used. Although these two are more commonly associated with other corvids, such as rooks and crows. Dr. Richard Collins.
Well, I prefer to use the term ceremonial gathering, is what you see in the literature, rather than parliament. It's a parliament of crows, but a ceremonial gathering of magpies. Now, this is a strange thing, pretty inexplicable. Now, what happens is this. The magpies are all in their territories. You've got your domain with your wife down there, and there's a fella down the road, and he's got his domain with his wife, and so on. And they're all nice and neat and handy, like the suburbs kind of thing. Then, suddenly, a pair of magpies flies into another pair's territory. And, of course, there's war. The defending pair kick up a row and fight back, and there's chattering and feathers flying and all kinds of things. And what happens then is that the neighbours, being like neighbours everywhere, gather and gawk on at this, you know, all in a big sort of group that are looking on, nosy parkers, wondering what the outcome is going to be. It has been suggested, a row usually ends in the old order being established and the intruders have been kicked out, and the old pair are in residence permanently. But it's suggested that in a lot of cases there's a wife swap or a husband swap, that at the end of the row the husband is ditched in favour of the new husband. Now, it's very hard to prove that. I know it from experience, even with swans, where they cross over and the cubs are fighting and the females go over for a gawk at the other guy's territory. Something the same may be happening in the magpies.
One for sorrow, two for joy. You know, that's not the only version, Terry. There's other versions. One for sorrow, two for mirth, three for a funeral and four for a birth.
Is it really bad luck to see one magpie and good luck to see two? There are many myths and superstitions associated with magpies. Ain't it, Ileana?
This is an old English rhyme, apparently, that was recorded way back in 1780, and it actually puts into words the whole idea that the magpie was a bird of ill omen and there were lots and lots of bad things associated with it. I mean, this version goes, one for sorrow, two for joy, three for a funeral, 4 for a birth, 5 for heaven, 6 for hell, 7 for the devil, his own self. So they didn't even have to worry too much about rhyming. But I mean, the devil, everything was brought into that one.
And is that because of the black and white colouring?
No, I don't think so. I think this is because there's been an awful lot of bad pishrogues associated with the magpie. Probably a lot of it to do with the harsh sound that it has. I mean, if you go back to the time of Noah's Ark, apparently, this was one of the only things that never went into the Ark. The magpie didn't go into Noah's Ark. Now you'd say, well, how is it still around then? Well, no, it perched outside up on top of the ark and spent the whole time giving out to Noah and telling him he wasn't doing it right. Obviously, he must have had the missus there as well. And the two of them gave out yards about the whole business from start to finish. So, I mean, from that time, there was a bad vibe going with the magpie. So I don't think it's something recent as all of that, in fact, you know. And of course, the other thing then it was associated with the devil, and it was associated with evil and bad fortune and all of this sort of thing. I mean, magpies eat other birds' eggs. They eat dead things that are on the ground, drink their blood. So, I mean, if you really wanted to give a dog a bad name and hang him, all of these things that the magpie does is bad, even though other birds do it too. But, I mean, the magpie seems to have gotten it in spades. And, of course, in Ireland, we've taken all this on board too, because on the beach in Bag and Bun, Ireland's cause was lost and won. And that's said about the Normans. That's where the Normans landed. But would you believe, that's also where the first party of magpies came ashore in the 1680s. Apparently they were blown over, a party of them from Wales, in some sort of a storm. And indeed, Irish people knew what magpies were. Here comes this terrible bird here to Ireland, and we're only after getting rid of Cromwell. I mean, the late 1600s in Ireland, people were starving. There was all kinds of savagery being carried out by soldiers and all of this sort of thing. And then to add insult to injury, along comes this wretched bird with all its baggage and bad fortune about it. And that didn't go down well either. Mind you, it came early enough that it got an Irish name. It's called an Snag Brack, which means the noisy one that actually is speckled, or brack means that it's black and white, it's speckled. But all this bad luck could be averted if you were nice to the magpie. So there's a whole big thing about, you know, if you meet a magpie in the morning, you salute it. Morning, Mrs. Magpie, how are you doing? How are your children? Are you off your hat to it if you're wearing a hat and you're a man? And this is all to give the respect to the magpie so that you won't end up with bad luck coming from this. And of course, it's considered to be bad luck if you only see one magpie, so you wink at the magpie, and that makes it look then that you've seen two magpies. I ask you, indeed. Kids nowadays have the rhyme, oh, down to a fine art: 1 for sorrow, 2 for joy, 3 for a girl, 4 for a boy, 5 for silver, 6 for gold, 7 for a secret that's never to be told, 8 for a kiss, 9 for a wish, and 10 for a bird that you must not miss.
As Aina has said, the Irish name for the magpie is Snag Brack, derived from Old Irish, referring to something that was speckled and noisy. But there has to be more to this black and white plumage than meets the eye. Richard Collins.
Now, the magpie is a beautiful bird. It's beautifully adorned, dressed, shall we say. It's in its finery. Now, that is an interesting subject. Now, the crows are notoriously black. So the basic structure of the magpie is black and white. You know, it's black above, white below, more or less. That's the main outline. Now, there is a theory used sometimes here that black and white is a kind of universal symbol in wilderness, in wild creatures, of danger. In other words, it comes from things like the skunk. The skunk is black and white, and the coyote comes to eat the skunk. He knows that this stinking smell will come rushing out at him. So the black and white tells him, don't go with that fella, you're going to be stank out of it, you see. So maybe that is one of the factors, that black and white might be a deterrent in itself. Now, the other thing, of course, is countershading, a big word. If you hold an orange there in the light, and the top of the orange is all lit up and beautifully orange, but the underside of the orange is shaded and it's a much duller colour, you see. And this is true of all objects. When you look around you, you expect an object to consist of brightened up and darker below. So things like magpies reverse that. They put the black up on top and the white below. And of course, what that does is it tricks the eye. So you tend not to notice a creature when it's got the reverse order, the black above and the white below. But also, if you are a prey species of the magpie looking up, your white belly against the light is it's harder to detect the predator above you with the white belly. Whereas if you're the predator up above trying to catch a magpie looking down, then the magpie above is black against the darker plumage, the darker conditions of a wood, for instance. The black tends to camouflage it against the predator above. The other element in this is breakup of the form. You see, if the form of a bird is very clear, but the patterns on the bird break it up, so you don't see it as a unit. You see it as a series of colour patches. It breaks up the outline, so you don't notice the bird shape anymore. So you have black and blue, beautiful blue, and white. So this is very important as well. It tricks the eye into not noticing the bird. It's a kind of camouflage. Camouflage in the case of the magpie is probably camouflage against a victim that it's known to attack, rather than being attacked by something else. Of course, they are used to be attacked by eagles and stuff like that, but it's less of a problem that now, do you see? So that's called countershading. A nice big name for that is countershading. Now, if you look at the rest of it, the lovely colours. Colour is usually in birds to prevent funny marriages from taking place. It's very true of things like ducks and finches and things. The males dress up usually in a colour scheme that attracts the correct female, females of their own species. They don't want other species to be attracted, because if they mate with those, they'll produce hybrid young that won't survive. So the magpie may be marked originally with all these lovely colours to make sure that no such errors occur. It may be that at some time in the past you needed careful discrimination between the magpies and other species in Europe to prevent this kind of erroneous crossbreeding. That might be an explanation.
You're listening to Marty in the Morning on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.
Have you noticed how springy it is lately? Have you? I'm not talking about the weather if you're outdoors now or later. Take a look at the Boyds. A lot of construction going on. They're building nests. It must be love. It seems every time I see a bird, it has a twig in its mouth. Twigs, who am I kidding? The branches, especially the magpies. And the poor old magpie gets a bad press. They have a reputation for stealing. Rumour has it. They love shiny objects. They can't resist anything that sparkles. Is it true? Well, Rossini thought so. In his opera, The Thieving Magpie, he tells the story of a maid who nearly lost her head for stealing silver from her employer. But she received a last-minute reprieve when it was revealed that the thief was actually a magpie. See, I told you, that had been hiding items in the church tower. Now I know where to look for my watch.
It seems there's no getting away from the magpie. In Ireland, if a person was a bit of a collector, we'd say, "Is Sciall a snagbracke?" He's a bit of a magpie. But what about the magpie's penchant for shiny objects?
I have a magpie story about a magpie's nest. You won't believe this, but I saw it with my own eyes.
Ain't any, Launa?
I remember about 30 years ago, or maybe it was not quite as long ago as that, I was invited to a big house on Parnell Square in Dublin. It was the offices of some organisation that sent for me. And they had this window with, you know, outside a balcony window and a railing around it. And in the window, there was a magpie's nest on that balcony on the outside the window. And the nest, and I seen it with my own eyes, Terry, with my own eyes, it was made entirely of coat hangers.
Coat hangers.
Coat hangers, of the wire coat hangers that you get in the dry cleaners. And of course there was the magpie. It must have been rather uncomfortable sitting on top of all of these coat hangers with its nest, like they normally make them out of sticks. So of course I was intrigued, and I was saying to the woman whose office it was and who was afraid of her life that the magpie would renege on the nest and had the place in darkness and we were peeping out through the blinds, I said, how did the magpie carry the hangers here? Did it carry them in its claws? Did it carry them in its beak? Oh, she didn't know. She never saw any of them coming. And you could be, there must have been 100 bloody hangers there. And I was nearly going to ask her, were there any clothes on the hangers as they were being swiped out of the, were they being swiped out of the dry cleaners? Where were they coming from? But no, no, we only saw it when the nest was actually in situ. I kept in touch. The magpie laid the eggs. The magpie hatched out the eggs and off they went. But whether it ever went back to Parnell Square to the dry cleaners hangers, I never heard the end of it, but I did see it with my own eyes. Conic me, Terry.
So it seems that seeing is believing. But the scientific community is full of doubting Thomases.
I studied wild magpies and their foraging habits for my PhD. And we did a lot of research on the campus of the university with the wild birds there and got a lot of interest from members of the public. Magpies are one of those animals that people either really like or really dislike. So luckily for me, most people in Exeter were quite fond of magpies and interested in my research and would stop and chat to me about it. But actually, they're very interesting birds to watch. You know, if you spend an hour watching a pair of magpies, then they're never doing nothing. You know, they're always quite busy, and so they're always up to something that I think is quite interesting to observe.
In 2014, research conducted at the University of Exeter revealed that not only do magpies not steal trinkets, but they are positively scared of shiny objects, as lead author of the study, Dr. Tony Shepherd, told Mooney Goes Wild.
We found no evidence for it, so that's not to say that it's completely untrue, but it's certainly in the birds we tested, we found no evidence of this attraction. And we tested wild birds in Exeter, and then also captive birds that were wild-born and then had come to us through a rescue centre. So it was a good sample size.
Yeah,
exactly. And we did perform multiple tests. So they didn't just have one exposure to the objects. We performed in total 72 tests. And in those tests, birds only made contact with the shiny object twice. And it was very brief. And it was after they'd depleted all the food that was available. So you wouldn't call it sort of an inherent attraction to the object.
Can you describe the test for me?
So we accustomed them to feed from two food piles on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then once they were regularly feeding from the food, we simply conducted a test with shiny objects next to one food pile and matte or dull-coloured blue objects in the same shape next to the other food pile. And we varied the shapes. We had rings, we had small screws, and then we also had just pieces of aluminium foil cut mm-hmm. into rectangles. And in the only object that was ever touched was the silver ring on two separate tests.
So you're saying they ignore them because the food is there? If the food wasn't there, would they be more attracted to these objects, I'm wondering?
Well, if the food wasn't there, we might not get their attention at all. This is why we use the food, is they become accustomed to me providing food. So when they see me coming, they would fly into the tree normally, right above where I put the food down. And so the food is put down really to get them to come to the ground and pay attention to what's going on the ground. So if we just put the objects down, there's a chance that they wouldn't bother to come down and investigate. Whereas if they want the food, they will come down.
But did you try that out?
We didn't try just objects, no.
No, exactly. You had different sites around the campus, correct?
Yes, we had 8 sites on campus.
Were they different birds?
They were, because magpies are very territorial. So, and particularly in urban areas, their territories are quite small. And when you're feeding a pair in their territory, if an intruder bird flies in from a different territory, you know immediately, because the resident pair will chase it off quite aggressively. And this did happen, you know, fairly regularly. There would be a bird would fly in while you had your pair down feeding, and it would get chased off every single time. So by feeding in the same location every day, you knew that you were testing the same two birds.
And by feeding at different locations, you knew you were getting a variety.
Exactly.
Which was very important for your study as well.
Absolutely. So we did make sure that all the test sites were at least 500 metres apart, which is about twice the size of the average magpie territory in an urban area.
OK, so why do we think they take shiny objects?
Well, I'm sure on occasion magpies have picked up shiny objects. I mean, animals have personalities just as humans do, so some birds might be more attracted to these objects than others. And as I said, even in my study, there were two occasions where a bird did pick up a shiny object. So as humans, we notice this as being unusual behaviour, and we tell people about it. And then these stories, as anecdotes, sort of spread through our culture, and then it just becomes sort of a fact that magpies are attracted to shiny objects. Rather like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So now that we know they're attracted, then we look for it. Mm-hmm. And when they pick up these shiny things,
say, there
we notice.
You go.
Exactly.
Told you so.
And then when they pick up really innocuous things like a twig, no one notices or comments on it.
Rossini's opera, The Thieving Magpie, was first performed in Milan in 1817. We've learned a lot about magpies since then. And just like the servant girl who was spared the gallows because it was concluded that the perpetrator was a magpie, today, thanks to our better understanding of the natural world, it's the bird's life that has been spared. Brendan Kavanagh.
I did have a lady that told me all about the magpie in her back garden. And I went out, had my ladder ready and drove out my high-ace van from Trinity. And when I got into the house, she said to me, "That magpie took my wedding ring and it's gone up to the nest there and the wedding ring is in the nest." I never found anything in a magpie's nest other than eggs or maybe eggshells or young. So rest assured, the magpie does not take your wedding rings off the window and take them away with them.
So the magpie is not a thief after all. But they certainly are responsible for causing a racket in the garden. What people may not realise is that magpies have many different vocalisations. Sound recordist Sean Ronayan explains.
So this first recording is an example of Babel's song. Magpies actually have a few different song types, and this is a song which is given early on in the breeding season.
It's very soft, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very soft song. It has some typical calls mixed in there. There's often some mimicry, and then you have these very unusual, high-pitched, odd sounds in amongst it all.
So this is a song as distinct from a call?
Yeah, corvids all have songs, but most people aren't familiar with them because they're often very quiet, and you have to be very close to hear them. In this case, I wasn't actually present. I had a recorder in a favoured perch of the male of the pair, and so it sang right above the perch. But if you were there in person, you'd have to be very close to hear it, and they wouldn't allow you to get that close.
So you were very lucky to get this recording then.
Out of 12,000 recordings in my library, I only have two recordings of magpie song.
Really? That few?
Yeah, it's... I don't think I've actually heard it in person ever. I've only heard it through the ears of my recorder. So this next one is completely different again, and this is actually a call, and it's a call from a flock of magpies. So what they're doing here is they're scolding a buzzard, which is perching in a tree. So a buzzard is a threat.
And how many magpies were there in that group?
I think there were about five in that group. They were just magpies that were in the vicinity and saw the threat. And once they start scolding, it will alert other magpies in the area to come in. And of course, there's safety in numbers. And the more that are scolding this buzzard, the more chance they have of actually scaring it off.
So it's not just about scolding, it's about also attracting in reinforcements.
Exactly, yeah. So of course, a buzzard would pose a serious threat to a magpie. And in fact, buzzards sometimes can take young corvids off the nest. So they grow up knowing that they are a threat, and so they'll band together to ward off that threat.
And what happened?
At first there was only one magpie scolding, and as the numbers built up, it was too much for the buzzard and it flew away.
So it worked?
Oh, it worked. So this is another call that I'm sure people will have heard. It's different to the previous two in that it's used as a contact call. So it's not alarmed and it's not displaying or maintaining territory. It's simply just maintaining contact with a partner or a buddy. So I saw these two birds. They were actually feeding on the ground. And as they were hopping along, they were just gently calling to one another, just to let each other know that they're still together, they're still safe.
So I presume because they mate for life, it's probably a pair.
It would presumably be a pair, yeah. And this final call is an interesting one, and it just shows how varied the vocalizations of magpies really are. So I was doing a bird survey in Gorey, and I heard an unusual call, really didn't know what it was, and I tracked it down and stuck my head around the corner, and here was a magpie giving this really unusual nasal call. And this often happens when you're studying common species for a long time. You realise that the vocal repertoire is much more than just a song and a call. In fact, there's multiple different calls for all manner of reasons. And this is a prime example of this.
We've all heard the phrase, survival of the fittest. It refers to the concept in evolutionary biology where organisms that are best adapted to their environment have a better chance of surviving.
I had an incident with them there about a number of years now when the pied whitetails built a nest in the pampas grass at the front of the house. And I have been observing them. As you know, I have a great fondness for our garden birds. And I was looking forward to seeing the young ones fledgling and all that kind of stuff.
These are the pied whitetails?
Yes. Mm.
Tony Darby has a large garden in County Meath. He recalls a harrowing experience of magpies raiding a pied wagtail nest, and he decided he needed to take action.
One morning, just after dawn, there was a dreadful commotion outside my bedroom window, and I got out of bed and it was the magpies were taking the nest apart. Right. And had the young fledglings out on the ground, and the parents were going berserk, to be honest with you. So I raced out anyway, and the magpies left immediately, but the harm was done. It was carnage now, to be honest with you. I'm rather upset I was over it. So anyway, the following year, and the pied whitetails once again built a nest in the pampas grass. And there was a repetition of it. The very same thing that happened the year before. Come at dawn and take them out. And take them out when they're quite well fledged, you know. And this time there was the last straw, so I didn't know how to handle it. So what I done was I removed the pampas grass, and I presume that the parents of the pied whitetails had built a nest somewhere else, but I haven't found it yet now, to be honest with you.
So what you did was you removed the pampas grass so that the pied whitetails couldn't nest
yes.
there.
Well, it was I couldn't think of anything else. Do you know what I mean? The magpies have a right to live as well, I suppose, but I just didn't like what was happening. I thought if I took a pampas grass out, we would be in a position where that somewhere else in the property there, they might be safe. What I did try, whether it was right or wrong, I decided that I would take home some meat from my butcher shop and I would feed it to the magpies during the nesting period. And I think they were very grateful for the meat, but they also took my pied whitetails. So after that, I decided I'd take out the pampas grass. I had no alternative. I wonder how other people would have handled it, you know, Terry.
Nature can be cruel, but the magpies are doing only what they must to survive. Professor Brendan Kavanagh.
It varies from different times of the year. At this time of year, moving forward with the young in the nest and that, the young are fed on insects. So they are basically primarily an insectivorous bird. But if they get an opportunity for a piece of protein, like almost any animal, they will take advantage of that. So they will take carrion at certain times of year, and they will also, if they get a chance, they will often take a bird, or they'd kill a bird as well.
And of course, that's what most people think of magpies as, the bird that comes along and robs another young bird from a nest.
Yeah, when I was doing my PhD, one of the things I looked at was their feeding habits. And It was amazing the amount of grain, for instance, that was in their crops in wintertime. And it was amazing the lack of any bird protein, if you want, you know, bird muscle. What they were feeding on in quite a large amount, even in wintertime, was beetles, insects in the grass.
So really they are omnivores with a very diverse diet.
You could even say, if I was pushed to say one type they are, I'd say they're insectivorous, but that's because that's during the breeding season when it's so important for them to reproduce. If you look at them over the 12 months of the year, they're definitely omnivores.
Do they cache food?
Oh yeah, yeah, they're very good at caching food. They're every bit as good as the jay in the way that they can cache food. And they will bury things like oak acorns, which they'll find later in the year. So, yes, I would definitely say they're expert cachers.
It's often said that corvids, the crows, the magpies, are amongst the most intelligent creatures in the animal kingdom. Is this true? And can they really recognise human faces?
Most animals can recognise humans, particularly if they're in an urban environment or in a farmyard or whatever. They'll know when somebody's coming out to put something in the bin, as opposed to when somebody's coming out with a view to trying to catch them or something like that. So yes, it's in the magpie's interest to be able to tell the difference between one individual and another. And most birds are like that when you think about it. I mean, the robin that'll come and land on your hand, or when you're digging the garden and it lands on the spade. I mean, these birds can recognise humans as sure as, in fact, better than we can recognise the individual birds.
So magpies are very intelligent then?
Yes, the crows are one of the most intelligent group of animals, of birds. Other things like blue tits and grey tits can be extraordinarily intelligent, but that's because they're inquisitive. But the magpie has quite a memory. They have more of a consciousness, if you want, than some species, and that's because of their intelligence and their memory.
Are they misunderstood?
I think we're all misunderstood, Terry, including the magpie. I take a very broad view of all wildlife. I feel wildlife struggles. We've too many people, if you want, almost disturbing natural habitats. It's a case where the magpie is just trying to survive in a changing environment, in a dynamic environment. And it's only one of many, many species. We're looking at a huge amount of mass extinction taking place right across the planet. And basically, nature is struggling to survive. And the magpie is just another one of those.
Love them or loathe them, magpies have been with us for a very long time. They are amongst the world's most intelligent creatures, capable of recognising themselves in the mirror test, making and using tools, and even working in teams. No wonder they've survived.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry Flanagan. That programme was first broadcast on the 1st of April this year. Now, I mentioned at the top of the programme, Mooney Talks, a series of talks given by experts in the field of natural history, four from University College Cork and four from Mooney Goes Wild. If you want to attend, it's happening on Friday the 3rd of May. Follow our social media over the next couple of weeks and indeed UCC's social media, and you'll find out how you can get your hands on some tickets. They are free, but we can only handle about 100 people or so. Each talk is only 13 minutes long, so be prepared for short, snappy presentations coming at you, as they used to say back in the day. Anyway, it's all taking place at University College Cork on Friday, 3rd of May. That's pretty much all we have time for. Don't forget, the Dawn Chorus is just around the corner. That'll be Sunday the 5th of May. I can't wait. 2 weeks from now. Talk to you next week. Bye.